Amityville Horror.
Possession.
3D.
Silence.
Harvest.
Strange Eons Radio presents the Amityville Horror Picture Show. That's Eric over there.
Whoa, where am I, man?
And I'm Kelly. We are your hosts on this kind of weird journey of the Amityville films. Each episode, we're going to be bringing in a different guest host, and I'm so pleased to announce that today's guest host is the inimitable Anthony James Kay. Hi, Tony.
Hello, gentlemen. I am delighted to be here.
Can you take 30 seconds and kind of brag about yourself and tell us what you're up to?
Oh, gosh. So my name is Tony Kay. I am a freelance writer in the Seattle area. At the moment, I'm writing for two different websites. One of them is called artisthome.org. It's a Pacific Northwest focused music website. And the other thing I'm writing for at the immediate moment is a website called thesunbreak.com, which is a film culture website also based out of Seattle. I also panel at Crypticon frequently. That is how I met these two gentlemen I'm sitting next to, and I am absolutely chomping at the bit to talk about the Amityville Horror.
You know, Tony, it's always such a pleasure to see you, but I have to admit, Eric and I just saw you a couple days ago, and yeah. I was like, am I going to be Tonied out? Guess what? I'm delighted to say that I love seeing you this morning just as much as I did days ago.
Oh, so. My God. The very bromance true. Is very back true. In full bloom. I'm so happy.
So let me open this up with a little bit of information on what we're doing here. We are talking about the Amityville Horror, the picture show, the movie that came out.
It's the kind of house they don't build anymore. A relic of a time when the world wasn't in such a hurry. When there was still time for a little charm and elegance. It has stood empty for a long while. And at the price, it is a bargain. For a growing young family, it is almost too good to be true.
What do you think?
I love it.
James Brolin, Margot Kidder, Rod Steiger, in the Amityville Horror.
God's peace in this house.
Kathy? Father Delaney, there's something very important.
After the Lutz family moved into their dream house, they were running for their lives. What happened to them is an experience in terror you will never forget. And you will believe in the Amityville Horror. From the best-selling book that made millions believe in the unbelievable, the Amityville Horror.
And the background on this is on November 13th, 1974, Ronald DeFeo Jr. shot and killed six members of his family at their house at 112 Ocean Avenue in Amityville. He was convicted of second-degree murder in November of 75, and in December of 75, George and Kathy Lutz and their three children moved into the house.
Oh.
After 28 days, the Lutzes left the house, claiming to have been terrorized by paranormal phenomena while living there. These events served as the basis for Jay Anson's 1977 novel, The Amityville Horror, which was then adapted into film in 1979. Now, the interesting thing about all of this, as Amityville is a real town and the stories of DeFeo and the Lutzes are historical, there is no proprietary relationship to the underlying story elements associated with the Amityville haunting. And so as a result of this, there have been no restriction on the exploitation of the story by film producers, which is the reason that most of these films share zero continuity, were produced by different companies, and tell widely varying stories. When I thought this would be a good idea for a podcast, I was thinking, you know, a limited series that just ends when we get to the final Amityville film. As of this recording, there's about 30 films with the Amityville title in it, and 9 of them have been made since 2019.
Holy sheep shit.
Jeez. But, you know, the high quality we're looking at in our future of Amityville in space and Karen.
I have a bad feeling about this because I have skipped ahead to some of these movies, you guys, and it is going to be it's going to be a struggle.
Yeah.
Has there been an Amityville with sharks yet?
Yes.
Okay. That's what I thought. Okay. Good.
But that's a spoiler for later in the run of the series.
That's right. We'll start from the beginning.
Right. So, just some quick background on this. The Amityville Horror, the movie, 1979, budget of about $4.7 million and a worldwide box office of over $86 million. It is considered one of the highest grossing independent films of all time. It was American International Pictures that put that out. It was directed by Stuart Rosenberg, who directed Cool Hand Luke, Brubaker, 46 other films, and it was written by Sandor Stern, who has a long list of made-for-TV movies, and this, which makes sense because this was originally going to be a made-for-TV movie. Did you guys know that?
If I hadn't have heard that from you, I would have suspected it strongly because the movie has that very kind of utilitarian flatness of a made for TV movie.
Yes.
And it just does.
And it's oddly long for that time frame. I mean, it's like, why is this movie 2 hours long?
Knives Out.
Seems much longer.
Yeah.
Yes.
It stars James Brolin, Margot Kidder, and Rod Steiger for some reason. I want to start every episode out this way. And since you're the guest, Tony, I'll ask you first. What is your Amityville Horror origin story? How did you become aware of this thing?
I think you have to be in our general demographic to really realize what a big cultural deal this movie was. You literally could not pass by a newsstand or a bookstore or a department store and not see like shelves and shelves of the Amityville Horror paperback. It was that iconic image of the house with those triangular windows. It's etched in popular culture for a reason. It was everywhere. Mm-hmm. I never had a chance to read the book. I ended up going straight into the movie, and I saw it when I was 12 years old, I think. No, I would have been 11. And I saw it at a theater called the Parkland Theater. And I consider myself to be a bit of a doctor of schlockology, I guess. And so the Parkland Theater was my grindhouse slash genre university. And so I saw it there. This was a theater that basically usually ran second run, like A-list features, or they did double features. And I started living in this area, which was Spanaway, Washington, about 10 miles south of Tacoma, in 77. So I would have seen this about 2 years after moving into the house my parents bought. It played as a single feature, which was kind of a rarity at the Parkland. If we had a single feature playing there, it was usually a second run, like mainstream Hollywood movie, or you would always get a package deal double feature. So this was kind of a special event movie by Parkland Theater standards, which you kind of had sort of a hierarchy of crap when it came to movies that you saw in rural Pierce County. That's a whole other story because there's also the military theaters, which made the Parkland look like I don't know, Grauman's Chinese. yeah, it was a packed house. And I remember the movie making a strong impression on me there. And I'm sure we'll get into it. There are scenes in the movie that still, I think, on some visceral level work. And the thing that I think stuck with me watching it the most at this point was what you just alluded to, which is that that made-for-TV quality that it has. And I think for me, I found it kind of like it gave the movie a patina that actually, I think, arguably made it scarier for me at the time, which is that it felt like a made-for-TV movie. It felt like a bad reenactment from an old In Search Of episode. And that patina of sort of verisimilitude, you know, sort of faked verisimilitude, really gave it an air of that kind of unsettling, gee, did this really happen? Maybe this really happened, you know, but bum-rushed by, you know, A-list actors. It's a very weird movie. I've watched it several times in prep for this.
Sorry to hear that.
What about you, Eric?
Mine is a little different. I don't remember when I actually saw it, but what Tony was talking about there with the original of the story and the way it was all over the place, it was a huge influence on me for horror in general. The concept, there's a group of films and their TV commercials, The Changeling, The Omen, and The Amityville Horror, that kind of all sit in the same place in my head of going, yeah, wow, this is like horrible, forbidden stuff. Because I'm a little younger than you, Tony, so I wasn't old enough to see it or to convince my parents to take me to it, because neither of them were really horror fans. But the omnipresence of it everywhere,
yeah,
and the story captured my imagination, because I'm like, holy shit, this is supposed to be a true story. And I don't know if you want me to tell you my full story about it now, you know, because it's definitely more the end of what happened with the Amityville Rush is what hit me the most.
Oh, well, save that for the ending then.
Okay, but for the film itself and the legend around it, it all was around the idea that this was real.
Oh, totally.
And I, you know, I was probably still in single digits, so it hit very much like, ooh, because I love that shit. I wanted to experience some paranormal thing as a kid. And this seemed like my best opportunity, at least for the time, for the early part of it, it did.
Yeah, I'm kind of there with you. I was fascinated with shit like this. And I remember we had the book in the house. My mom had read it. It was the black cover. I don't think it had the picture of the house on the cover, but it did have the,
it's like the glowing eye thing or something.
No, it was a black cover. It just said the Amityville Horror, and then
in that font, though,
with the devil tail coming off of one, yes, of like, okay, the Y, yeah, or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was, but I remember being terrified of it because we lived in kind of a old haunted house at the time, with a creepy basement, and it made weird noises and doors would creak open whenever it wanted to and shit like that. So I was kind of a scared kid anyway. And then I just surrounded myself with that shit. I remember being taken to this in the theater by my sister and her, it's either a boyfriend or a husband. You know, I would have been 9, I guess.
Probably, yeah.
And I remember that I was like terrified coming out of that. But her boyfriend, we get out and he's like, did I just spend $3 to watch a chair rock by itself and see some glowing Christmas lights outside of a window? So
not impressed.
Yeah, he was not impressed.
You need to get him for the podcast, man. I tell you.
I'm still in very good touch with him. Probably much better relationship than my sister has with him at these times. Okay, so the movie opens with the DeFeo murders. I watched this movie just recently for the podcast as well, and I thought to myself, this is a pretty chilling opening scene.
Yeah.
I thought it was really effective.
Yeah, and I think the editing is, I think it's interesting, the editing that they do, where there's intercuts of just the shotgun fire, and then, and here's the bedroom.
Yeah.
Da, da, da. I mean, it's not exactly the most innovative of, like, editorial/filmmaking devices, but it worked, you know?
Yeah, I love that in the opening sequence, the shotgun is being blasted, but the thunder is also crashing. So, yes. You know, there's kind of a kind of an explanation why nobody would be waking up, I guess. Although I think it'd be hard to sleep through that storm, quite honestly.
There's a little bit of the cat jumping out to the sound effects, but it all works really well.
Sure.
You know, it's just sort of a jump scares. But at that point in the film, that kind of jump scare doesn't bother me in a movie when it's used that well.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the music, I thought, at least at the beginning, I kind of like the opening credits music and the stuff that's going on with that.
Yeah.
That doesn't necessarily last through the whole movie. But
you know, it's funny. I think that's part of the charm for me is the score, which is Lalo Schifrin, who did a lot of amazing stuff in the 70s. And it's equal parts brilliant and club you over the head, hammy as shit, you know? You've got that very creepy childlike theme, but it's like swirled up with these earnest kind of heartwarming after special school music type, you know, music motifs. And then you've got the psycho violin strings, you know, which come at like key points. In fact, I think they pop up when there's the cat jump scare and it's and I'm just thinking to myself, Rosenberg, I'm just picturing him as like this grumpy old man who's like, all right, kids, you bunch of jump scare. All right, here's a cat. There's a cat going hiss, meow. See, he's going to get you. Oh, you know, and it feels like, I mean, there's this sort of like old prose vigor to a lot of the scares that surface. It's not like super artful, but it's like, oh, the kids want some graphic violence. We'll throw it in here. You know, it's And it is if very much, I mean, it's a 1979 era amusement park ride, roller coaster ride, you know, as any, you know, competent, if not game changing horror movie at the time would have been.
Sure. Okay, yeah. A year after the murders take place is when George and Kathy Lutz tour the house. They're told about the murders, and then they make an offer of $80,000 on a house that we are told is worth at least $120,000.
That was so like, wow, man.
Eric, you've been looking for houses. Uh-huh. What are you finding in the $120,000 range these days?
I'm guessing that some of the tents you see on the side of the road now are those $100,000 units.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Yeah. And then at one point she says, Kidder's character says, might as well be $800,000. And I'm like, $800,000? You lucky dog. I'm dating someone who has been house shopping and just recently bought a house and paid more than $800,000 for it.
Not hard to do.
Significantly more in West Seattle.
Well, listen to this, you guys. Yeah. The house is 5,000 square feet. It has 5 bedrooms, 3.5 bathrooms, and a boathouse. And in 2017, it sold for $605,000 is all.
Whoa.
Really?
Asking price was $850,000. I'm guessing that it still gets a lot of weirdo traffic, and that probably is knocking the price down.
Well, I heard they rearranged those signature windows have been changed.
Yeah,
and they're just now regular.
The pumpkin eye windows are gone. Yeah. I got a question for you guys. First of all, do you believe in the supernatural?
I would.
That's broad. Do you believe in ghosts?
I would frame it this way in that I really want to.
I would agree. That's me. I'm all Mulder. I'm largely Mulder on this. Yeah. I want to believe. I mean, spiritually, I think of myself as an agnostic. I don't know what the hell there is out there. I would like there to be something beyond this mortal coil. I think it would be, you know, it's like Kurt Vonnegut said, you know, then at least we'd know at the end what was the good news? What's the good news? If anything. but yeah, I mean, I'm always open-minded to it. I want more evidence. But I would like it to be there.
Glowing orbs don't do it for you?
Not quite.
Well, there was that time a few years ago, your real estate agent friend offered us to stay in a haunted house.
No, we tried to get her to.
Okay, that's what it was.
She had a house that was supposedly haunted that she was trying to sell, and we were trying to get her to let us stay for a night and film.
Yeah, but that didn't happen.
But with that in mind, then, what would it take for you guys to say no to a house, even if it was a screaming deal, six six people being murdered a year before, is that enough for you to go, eh, not for me?
In Seattle, no. In Seattle, it would take a Jonestown massacre-sized, mass grave to maybe... And even then, it would just be, oh, well, knock $20,000 off because 600 people died here instead of 20, you know, or whatever. Yeah. It's, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm only slightly joking on that.
The idea of hanging around energy or something. I mean, if you're thinking there's a negative energy, then you also can think you can get rid of whatever that negative energy is. If that's the reason you're not wanting to buy it, do whatever you need to have that whatever ritual or whatever will make you feel that's gone. And then... remember, it was just a house.
Well, okay, so you're saying that now. You're married. Mm-hmm. Your wife is okay with six people being killed?
I don't know. She might have a very, very different, very different approach. Because, yeah, like you hear we don't live in anything remotely resembling a haunted place. You know, it's a condo building. But you still get the weird noises. And we do have a weird crawl space above our place. And so every once in a while, she's like, oh, what's that? And when she's going, oh my God, what's happening? I'm like, ooh, is there something cool? Come on, bring me something. Let me see the cat staring at something on the wall. And I walk over there and it's like 40 degrees colder in this spot.
Right. Oh, good heavens.
Anything like that. It's like, oh, that would be cool.
So, okay, Kathy is religious, George is not, but
he changes religions.
He's okay, though, with her bringing in a priest to bless the house, and that priest is Rod Steiger, mm-hmm. clearly in need of rent money. he's awful in this, right? That's not just me.
There is something operatic in the badness of his performance. Yes. It's just, it's one of the things where what did I write in my notes? The Steiger ham is about to burst out of its can. I'm just waiting for it. Yeah, there's a point where you start to see the slow burn. It's not really very slow. Right immediately after he has the incident with the flies, where he goes to visit the house. He can't. The Lutzes aren't inside the house, and then he has a visitation from flies and something that smells really
out.
Oh, and that's another thing that actually stuck with me. It stuck with me from the trailers. It stuck with me from the movies is the intonation of get out. It's not get out. It's get out. it's like the first syllable is get and the last syllable is tout. But it works. It works.
Yeah.
So, and then actually another thing that I was really just getting down to little things that work in the movie, when he's in there and the flies start swarming, at one point, it goes completely silent, and then you hear the voice go, get out, and then it starts to build back up again, and I thought that was a nice little touch.
It's a pretty effective scene, but let's talk about this character, because he plays a major part in the book and the movie, and then I've got some news at the end of this. We get the phone calls full of static.
Right.
Which I'm not sure exactly what is going on here story wise. The evil follows him for whatever reason.
Yeah,
Is it just because he had the balls to bring his religion into this place and they're going to make him suffer? Because that doesn't seem to be the case with anybody else.
Right? It's hard to say. Now I watched the MGM DVD from 16 years ago or whatever, but it also has a commentary on it by Hans Holzer, who's a paranormal investigator who actually investigated the real life Amityville case. And it's very entertaining commentary because he goes through point by point as the movie's running and points out the areas where, okay, this is sort of the truth, kind of maybe a little bit, but by 45 minutes into the movie to an hour, and it's an almost 2 hour long movie, he's basically like, this is bullshit. This is bullshit. This is Hollywood. This is bullshit. This is bullshit. It's amusing because every little, progressively more operatic plot twist, and he's like, that's Hollywood. And I'm like, yes, indeed, it is.
Yeah. Well, we're also given that scene towards the end of his storyline, the priest, where he's in the church, the statue of Mary crumbles, mm-hmm, and he goes blind.
Yeah.
But the statue didn't crumble. And so, to me, I'm like, okay, was everything in his head? Was this whole thing just him going crazy coincidentally?
Yeah, it's a strange deviation in the story that seems... It's a B story that isn't... It doesn't connect to the A story very much at all.
Yeah.
Once he's gone, he never really communicates with her again because it's always phone problem interference.
I would not be surprised if it was some sort of weird budgetary limitation and they like were doing something to edit around the fact that they couldn't get Steiger and Margot Kidder and James Brolin in the same room at the same time. It almost feels like that because you don't really see a lot of them together. Or do you at all?
No, except for the fact that that is part of the story in the actual book. Mm. I would think that this was a rewrite.
Yeah.
That had to be added in afterwards or something like that.
It just doesn't fit. Right. We can get Rod Steiger in here. What's he going to do? Well, we don't know. We'll come up with some shit. The acting moments you're talking about, the fly one's a little over the top, but that final scene when the crumble and the...
Yeah.
And it's like, it is so over the top and so big and so disconnected from anything going on in the house. It's not like they're flashbacking to the house and the house is shaking and reacting to his prayers and something's going on. It's just all right here in his little world with him and this strange priest who starts out as kind of a creepy guy on the phone for whatever friggin' reason.
Right.
And just follows him around but doesn't investigate anything. I'm not sure that... Yeah, the whole priest element doesn't tie back into the house at all.
You know, you say that, and I would have loved it to go back to the house and heard that ghostly voice chuckling or something.
That would have been
damn
bright.
Right, you're blind.
I'm looking through my notes, and one of my notes, it's just, the ham is unleashed.
Yeah,
Steiger is off the fucking chain. My favorite part, and this is the scene where he actually is like, confessing this to the two superior priests, including Murray Hamilton from fucking Jaws, basically being a doubting Thomas, although a more benign doubting Thomas and slightly less cynical than the one he plays in Jaws. But Steiger has one of the greatest lines in cinema history when he goes, I am not some pink-cheeked seminarian who doesn't know the difference between the supernatural and a bad clam. I am a paranormal or I am a psychological investigator or whatever the fuck. And it's like, and Murray Hamilton is right up there like, who do you think you are? And I'm just thinking, oh my God. These guys, you know, the fucking both cans of ham have been opened up and they are unleashed.
I almost see like the director in the background, you know, if it was done now, he'd go, well, take it to 11 or give me the Nicolas Cage.
Thank you.
Because he just goes from relatively calm to whoa in like 2 seconds flat. Well, it's like, man, you were triggered.
And what's happened to trigger him? He goes into a house, it smells a little and some flies collect on some shit. Including on him, you know, which, you know, maybe you should be thinking about your hygiene if flies are drawn to you like that. I know it's all supernatural, but
speaking of the flies, did you guys come across the DP's problem with that scene?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's terrified of flies. So he would, on the close-ups of the flies, he shut his eyes.
He just pointed the camera and hoped that he got a good shot.
Oh, my God.
Like, wow.
I love it.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, well, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, I, not to be grouchy old man, but this is something that CGI cannot do. CGI cannot truly reproduce. I mean, one of the things that's actually pretty impressive to me is that Steiger is emoting with like progressively larger amounts of flies on him because he's actually got honey smeared on himself.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not the same if you have like a CGI fly crawling on somebody's skin. If you have a real fly crawling on somebody and you can see it's a real fly, it does make a difference. It helps with the visceral impact of what you're seeing, I think.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I was uncomfortable with the fly on his forehead. I was just like, ugh, yeah. Gross.
God, I know. You know, and he's just sort of standing there. And then he does that great Rod Steiger glower where he like whips around. He kind of looks over his shoulder and he's got like four or five flies clinging to one cheek. And then you hear the buzzing and it's genuinely unsettling.
It is one of the better scenes in the film.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So then when the nun comes, which is her sister. And I think I knew that it was her sister, but it felt like it finally clicked for me that this was her sister and they weren't just calling her sister.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. Yes.
She shows up, gets very ill also, drives away. Now, this is one of the very strong memories I have from being in the theater, because she pulls over and she opens the door and she vomits. And some wisecracker in the back of the theater goes, she must have just eaten at McDonald's. And everybody just lost it in the theater.
I must say, she hurls well. I was like, I was watching it this time around. I was thinking, you know, that's a very convincing hurl, because sometimes you just get like, you know, you'll get an actor will just like cough.
Sure.
They'll cough. And it's like, no, this person isn't Ralphing. They're just coughing. And she's like, she's got her gut into it. It's great.
Yep.
Do you think, so at the opening scene, we get the shot of the police officer who's there investigating the murders. And then we've got Rod Steiger here. It almost feels like they were thinking The Exorcist. We need a grizzled detective, and we need a priest to come in here to really nail home this satanic thing we got going on. And speaking of that, this was just prior to the Satanic Panic, but I can't help but think that maybe this kind of started the Satanic Panic, because this was all over the news. There were multiple evenings where before it was a movie, they were talking to the Lutzes and all this stuff. And it really kind of put in our minds that, you know, Satan was alive and well and living on planet Earth.
That's an interesting point. And I think there's something to it. But I think that a lot of that is because of the movie, because the actual story, I mean, Holzer, the investigator, who actually thinks that some weird things happened there, even though they were exaggerated in Hollywood fashion. I guess the story was that he talked about this like it was physics, like it was gravity, like it was science. No, yeah. He said that it was because, you guessed it, the original site of the house was built on an Indian burial ground. It was built on sacred land. And so when they moved the house, like brick by brick or board by board or whatever, to a different part of town, the haunting stopped. It was that spot. And Holzer asserted that George Lutz was possessed by the ancient indigenous, Native American who was who reportedly had died and wanted nobody on his sacred land. That was the story that they had. But the movie makes it. The movie is like it. I mean, you know, at one point, Murray Hamilton's character, the Father Superior or whatever, says, and not once have we ever heard that something like this was satanic. You know, so that's the first time you really hear the word satanic, but that plants it in your head for the rest of the movie. And obviously there's no reference to an Indian burial ground, which is something that I think Poltergeist,
the portal to hell.
Yeah. Which is something that Poltergeist, of course, I think very cleverly. Poltergeist, the more I think about this movie in tandem with Poltergeist, it feels like Poltergeist was almost a self-aware satire of the Amityville horror in some ways that I think they learned from the operatic hamminess and too straightforwardness of the Amityville horror when they went in and made Poltergeist.
My dad famously calls bullshit on every Indian burial ground story because my dad's a full Haida Indian. And he's like, listen, this entire planet is an Indian burial ground at some point. There are dead people under your feet wherever you walk. So that's a load of bullshit. And when he told me that, I was like, you know, you have a point.
Oh, so disappointing. We need more.
I tell you.
Kathy's brother's engagement party. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize this was a thing. I think every time I've watched this in the past, I thought it was a wedding.
Yeah.
And this time I spent a little more time or attention and found out it was an engagement party. An engagement party that he has to pay $1,500 to the caterer for?
For a house, and you could buy a house for 80 grand or 100 grand, but it's $1,500 for a caterer.
Tell me about it.
That is such a strange scene. I'm like, does the ghosts need cash or something? I mean, why What
is he a secret asshole?
Yeah, it's just like, oh, hey, what can I do? Oh, I know what I can do now.
That's right.
It's one of the interesting, I actually listened to, just a few months ago, coincidentally, I listened to a podcast, The Faculty of Horror, the one that's done by by two of the women that are involved in Rue Morgue magazine, I think.
Oh, okay.
Alex nice. West and Andrea Subisati. It's a great podcast. And they talked about the Amityville Horror in the context of being the ultimate real estate fear film, the ultimate real estate horror film, because basically nice. it's like a scarier, more demonic version of The Money Pit, that old Tom Hanks movie, you know, the house to see, you know, when the toilet's belching up, it's so funny because in the movie, in the Amityville Horror, when the toilet is like belching up all this inky black goop and it's just not stopping, Margot Kidder, Kathy Lutz is pretty nonplussed. She's annoyed, but it's not like she's shooting out of bed and screaming, "They shot her in the head!" Right. Like she does when she wakes up from one of her dreams. She's just like, "Oh, damn it! It's spitting up inky black whatever." And that obviously could be not in the least bit satanic. That could just be crappy pipes or
pretty bad pipes
septic
and
things going on.
God knows what those people in that house were eating.
Oh, yeah,
God,
except that it was. There was oil, so
the value just went up in this house.
Well, I'm like, that stuff was so viscous and black that any normal person would say, we should probably have this tested and see what's going on here.
Call You'd a think. Plumber, maybe? Shall we give Something. That a shot?
Well, so with that going on, with the money being going missing and all of this stuff, I have had money go missing, and I've had bad shit happen to me, and all this stuff. And I suppose that if I were a certain kind of person, and I were inclined to believe in this stuff, that maybe I would just start saying everything was, you know, the devil or something, because we all need something to blame, right? When things start going wrong.
Yeah,
so, with that in mind, I think we could look at some of the stuff in here. And say, it does make me wonder, why was this a part of the story? The $1,500.
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, it's funny because I think it's almost like this is America is the ultimate in consumerist culture and the ultimate in capitalism, and this is our way of exploiting the worst fear that a privileged white moviegoer can have, which is misplacing $1,500.
Well, it's a strange, it's used as a strange vehicle too, because then he writes the check to the caterer.
Right.
And then his business partner shows up later saying, well, your check hasn't gone through and you're not signing for all this stuff. It's like, I got to tell you, at this point, I don't really need reinforcement that he's losing his shit.
Yeah.
I kind of get that.
Right.
And then, you know, he takes him out for a beer and everything seems okay. So it's like, what is going on here with this? Weird storyline tangent that...
I think the whole point of that was maybe getting him away from the influence of the house was all it took for him to kind of snap out of it. The real horror in this film was I'd forgotten that he owns a surveying company.
Oh.
And I was a property land surveyor for 22 years and I was near suicidal at the end of it. I hated it so much. So that was a triggering moment for me.
They're not paying him. He's not paying his people.
The other thing that I found very interesting, which again is something that totally went over my head, is am I the only one who saw some strong homoerotic tension between George and his business partner?
I think there's a lot. I didn't see that, but.
Because when they first meet up, there's all these little implications. I mean, there's the way that the actor, you know, Michael Sachs looks at George's character, at Brolin's character, you know. I mean, it just feels like there's, you know, at one point they meet at a bar, and I guess George is late, and you know, the Michael Sachs character looks up and is like, thought I might be stood up. And then there's another point. And then at the other point, and this gets back to the whole consumerism thing, but mixed with the homoeroticism, there's a scene where Jeff comes over and he's trying to get George Lutz to sign the checks because he's the business owner. You need to sign the checks. We haven't paid our guys yet. Oh, and by the way, some caterer is all pissed off because you wrote a check for $1,500 that you fucking bounced. And then George is like, at this point in time, he's not bathing. So he's got like armpit rings and he's been wearing the same goddamn gray sweatshirt for the whole, up until this point and all the way and through the rest of the movie. And then at one point, George is like, well, tell me some good news. And then Jeff, his business partner, is like, well, I got you the spotlight for your boat. And then George all of a sudden lights up.
It's
like
really
the consumerist
worked.
Thing comes back, oh, you're giving me a thing, an item. And then at that point, Jeff's character looks at him. He goes, "I'll install it for you." And the energy in between these two guys, I'm sorry, it's there. Not that there's anything wrong with that, of course, but it's there.
Tony, you have convinced me. I wasn't seeing this. Clearly, this
is what happens when you watch the damn movie five times in a relatively rapid clip.
I think that it definitely straddles the line between homoerotic and super homoerotic.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. And it's also an interesting because it's the only. This is, I'm going to go off on a total movie nerd side tangent for about 2 minutes.
Not
here.
You.
Heavens forbid. Michael Sacks, the only other significant role I know that Michael Sacks played is he's the lead in George Roy Hill's film version of Slaughterhouse-Five. Yeah. He plays Billy Pilgrim. And he works really well in that movie because there's this kind of placid everyman cipher quality to him in that movie. And here it's interesting because he feels very awkward and clunky. And I'm like, it really reflects how much he worked, how much his everyman almost blandness really worked well for the character of Billy Pilgrim, who's, time hopping and sort of more observing what's happening in his life than an active participant in it. And then, trying to play a guy who is an active participant in his life, or specifically in his and George Lutz's life, apparently, like Brokeback Amityville or something.
I'm sure that will be produced very shortly.
But yeah, there we go. Oh my, no, man, there's no copyright. You can make Amityville anything.
My family moved into their new home in Amityville, Long Island. It ended 28 days later when they fled the house in terror. During that time, they endured a nightmare of evil, a plague of unnatural, inexplicable, and horrifying events, which began when their 5-year-old daughter boasted of a sinister new playmate. The Amityville Horror, more terrifying than The Exorcist, because it actually happened. Read it now in Pan Paperback.
Let's talk about Jody. The malevolent Jody. Malevolent pig demon who is apparently also supposed to be the ghost of one of the DeFeo girls.
Sure. After a half a dozen views, sure. I am no fucking closer to understanding that entire arc / subplot than I was when I was 12 years old. Yeah. It's no clearer now than it was then. It's so muddled. And I mean, it gets back to the whole thing. This is a 1979 state of the art amusement park ride, And so you get, but then it's also got it's interspersed with all these great, like cheesy made for TV bits, like the whole like car crash scene or the almost car crash scene when the hood flips up on the car that Father Delaney, Rod Steiger's character is being shuttled around by the Don Stroud character, the other reverend, like absent / abusive parenting.
Sure.
Because they really go out of their way to kind of show how the dysfunction is going. I mean, there's one point where the little girl is sitting outside the house underneath a window while her brothers are dangling a spider. And she's role playing with her dolls. And she's like, "Don't be a smartass." And she's like really tearing into him. She's like berating them the same way that James Brolin, that George Lutz is berating them, I mean, every third sentence
that George Lutz's character utters at those children is, God damn it.
Well, I think, though, to show the influence of the house, because when we first see him, he's given a real save the cat moment where he's talking about, you know, it'd be nice if they referred to me as dad and all that stuff. And he wants to be loved. And I think we're supposed to see that he is changing very quickly. Remember, all this stuff is happening within a span of weeks, 28 days total. Yeah, 20 days. So, you know, all the stuff we've already talked about, what was that, 14 days maybe? So we're seeing a lot of shit go on here, and it seems like there should be time between all of this stuff, but there isn't. There can't be, according to this story.
Well, yeah, you know, and I mean, as is, it pulls a cardinal sin in my mind of most horror movies, which is it's almost 2 goddamn hours long, and it doesn't need to be 2 goddamn hours long.
Yeah, thank you, Tony.
And even with that in mind, the lack of characterization feels super rushed. I mean, it's like Steiger's character goes from like 0 to 1,000 after smelling something that doesn't smell good and, you know, having some flies bugging his ass.
Right.
And then he's like, he's instantly at this operatic, like Italian horror movie level hamminess. It's amazing.
Yes, very true.
But it feels that way because, like you said, a couple of weeks are supposed to have gone by. And I would take the position that I think George Lutz is kind of a prick from the outset. He just strikes me as kind of a dickhead right from the get-go. And I don't see him. I mean, yes, he wants love, but I also see that almost that could be like a self-absorbed, you know, like manipulative needing of gratification of having these kids, like respect/worship of him.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, my dad was a grumpy, strict kind of guy who, you know, gave love, but was also, he was the person I was scared of in the house. You know, if mom said no, I'd whine my way until she said yes. If dad said no, that was it.
You know,
and so maybe I'm looking at this guy and projecting my dad onto him, who I know is indeed a good person, but probably, you know, yelled at me much the same way that George yelled at those kids.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting is it's interesting watching this movie through the frame of 21st century sensibilities, because as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, you know, the Lutzes, you know, what happens when they move out of this evil house, but into another house? And George goes back to punching on his wife. Then he can say, this house is haunted too. It's making me do it. It's making me knock you to the moon, Alice, or whatever. I think you can actually view the movie, and you kind of get back to what you were saying about it being a psychological thing and about, is this, you know, is a key amount of this happening in the character of Rod Steiger, the priest's head. I'm thinking how much of this is happening in the head of George Lutz. How, you know, is this, you know, has this living in this house, has it sort of subliminally, you know, tickled this impulse and is his psyche finding a way to rationalize and justify him, you know, smacking his wife around and like verbally, if not physically, abusing and berating the kids? You can look at it from that whole angle.
It's a good point.
You're giving the movie a lot of credit.
I know.
Much about the movie, I think it probably would have been.
Yeah, I mean, but it's better. And I wasn't thinking of it in terms of it. This is how intelligent it's being. I was thinking in terms of this is doled out with like TV movie benign flatness, you know. And so it's not like this is the way things were back then. You know, you slapped your woman around to get her in line. You know, that's 1979 movie mentality. And so the fact that he's like this kind of abusive bastard, I think.
Well, so is his friend.
Yeah. Oh, there's God, that, totally.
That there's that scene one in the scene bar where he just berates his wife like, Jesus, dude.
Oh, God. Yeah. Lord. He's got one key line that he belts out that was like, that like I was like, oh my God. And his girlfriend slash wife is played by Helen Shaver, who is a Canadian actress that I've almost had a soft spot for. I've seen her in a lot of stuff. She's a trooper. I think she's a really good actress. I actually think she gives a better performance than Margot Kidder does.
I would agree.
Yeah. She's good. She's not in it much, but what she does really well. Yeah,
exactly. And there's one scene where Michael Sacks's character is like, you know, you sound like some psycho weirdo when she's, you know, elaborating on what could possibly be going on. And then at one point he just yells at her, thank you very much for your cosmic views. Now do me a favor and shut up.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and then they just keep going on. It's like, NBD, no big deal. You know, wow.
Yep. Yeah.
Things has changed.
Nice line reading there. I think you nailed it.
Oh God. Yeah. And it's what's interesting. I wonder how much this movie, because I see Italian horror cinema in everything, I wonder how much this movie influenced and was influenced by Italian cinema, because there's aspects like the score, the opening theme with that child like la la laing is sounds very goblin, sounds like, you know, very Suspiria. And then you have the absolutely over the top acting. I mean, you know, Steiger's performance really belongs in like a Lucio Fulci zombie movie. You know, and actually, speaking of which, Helen Shaver, she's all psychic and shit. And she's talking about the house being built on special land. And I kept on thinking as I'm watching her do this, and her voice starts changing at one point. She's like, she's talking like an orc that's gargled acid or whatever. And then I'm sitting there watching her doing this and hearing her do this and thinking, this is so Catriona McCall. This is like her character. This is getting deep dive Italian cinema. But she's like the leading lady in City of the Living Dead, The Beyond. Sure. Very expressive face and very much she's always playing the psychically sensitive women. And Helen Shaver is playing that role only in a mainstream Hollywood movie. Now this is before most of Fulci's like big epics. So maybe this character was an influence on Italian cinema. Who knows?
That's an interesting thought, because this did very, very well overseas.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. So why is it a big deal that George Lutz looks like Ronald DeFeo?
I'm not entirely certain, other than it gives the bartender a nice line or two.
And I was like, okay, he does. And in real life, he does look a little bit like him also. Yeah. Because every man with shaggy hair and a big beard looks like each other.
Yeah. It's like the 21st century. It's like the equivalent of the hipster in the 21st century with his beard and his, know, his hipster
outfits.
So
I'm trying to figure out why this is even a thing. Why does anyone care that he looks like him? And they make a big deal out of it.
Especially when she finds the newspaper with the picture of, obviously, James Brolin. Boy, he looks just like him. Yeah, he really does. I don't know. Because it's a weird association, because how much does she learn about what that family did before that? I mean, it's just, I don't know. I don't see a purpose for it.
The purpose is that it gives another excuse for a random, you know, curve in the amusement park ride where George Lutz is digging into one of the walls with a pickaxe, and by the time he digs into it through the open hole, he sees a superimposition of what looks like his face,
right?
But not quite. It's not quite his face, and the reason why, and this is in the documentary on the DVD, is that it's James Brolin's brother.
Yeah, I saw that,
and I'm like,
nice,
because they wanted to make him look like
similar,
him, but
not exactly identical.
But
why?
To what end?
There is no reason for it.
Ronald DeFeo is the one who lived out of all those people. Why would his spirit somehow be in? It just makes no fucking sense.
Yeah.
The haunting spirit is a rustic old pioneer guy, cover, big beard, all that stuff. So he's the one.
It's not Lutz who looks like DeFeo. It's Lutz and DeFeo look like the spirit.
There
and that's
you
what
go.
We should all be yes. scared of. Speaking of that, that tearing into the wall thing, I thought the dog digging at the wall was super effective.
Yeah.
And bloodying its paws trying to get to whatever was in there. I thought it was a really good scene.
And it's foreshadowing to what happens to the babysitter later, too.
Of course, right.
I mean, it's not exactly elegantly and subtly delivered, but it's foreshadowing.
That is a really solid scene, and that girl, that actress, is fucking giving her all
there. Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was creeped out during that scene.
When they kind of react like, well, it's no big deal. I mean, the kid, why didn't you let her out? It's like, this girl over here is freaking the fuck out. Maybe something actually happened, exactly. And you might consider something's wrong with your door, at least.
It's yes. Just like,
that is not a child acting like, I just want to have some fun with the Lutzes.
You know, right. But I think, you know, again, if we want to attribute a layer that this movie probably shouldn't get credit for to it, I found that the babysitter character, yeah, she brings it in terms of the terror and the fear. And she's also every bit as dismissive and borderline abusive to the kids.
Oh, yeah,
as
definitely.
Any of the adults. So she's like right in there, you know. Don't you bat talk me. And I'm like, oh, God. God bless America.
Go to bed, you little shits.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It is the East Coast, you guys.
That's just true. That's true.
I'm bigger contributing
factor. I'm way back Northwest guy, so I'm not accustomed to. And my mother was a saint. She never yelled at me like that. So.
Humble brag.
if that's what I'm humble bragging about, then I'm.
Well done.
Yeah. There we go. Hi, Mom. You're the greatest.
So
she took me to this movie, by the way. My mom took me to every shit horror movie that I begged her to take me to because she was at home with two snot-nosed, bored-ass kids and she had to do something. So I'd drag her to a fucking horror movie and then, like, she'd come out of it shaking her head going, Anthony, I can't believe you made me sit through that. And then a week later, I'd have her sitting in a theater watching the fucking incredible Melting Man.
Oh, nice.
And then the cycle would begin anew. But I diverge.
I would say that my mom was that way too, in that she was actually into scary movies and scary books. So we had mm-hmm. Stephen King books and stuff in the house. And so it was no surprise to find this book in our house. Okay, so they break down the wall. They find out they have a well to hell in their basement. And
well to hell.
And
that's a t-shirt there. Amityville Horror. Well to hell.
Isn't that what the well to hell.
Isn't that what the hippie girlfriend calls it?
Yeah, basically.
So, and then, you know, one night, all hell breaks loose. The walls start bleeding for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. And the stairs.
yeah. Everyone is under attack. And that is their 28th day. They escape. I thought there was a real nice redemption moment for George when he goes back for Harry.
Yeah. And Harry gets all, you know, Harry is obviously learned by example and is a very big dick at first to George. Decides, fuck you. I'm going to put my fangs in your ass. And then he's like, oh, wait, dude's trying to save me. Okay.
Let's go.
I got the feeling that he just didn't recognize George. And it seemed like, I mean, arguably the dog is the best actor in this.
At that point in time, he smells George. George has been wearing the same shit. And a dog has a profound, pronounced sense of smell. So that dog fucking knows who George Lutz is. I don't buy that for an instant.
I'm just saying
unless
that
the black ooze that he's covered with, like, completely masks all smell, even to, you know, super hyper sense-focused dog smell.
I'm just saying that there did seem to be a moment, a look on the dog's face where he suddenly realized, oh, it's George.
Yeah.
Now, maybe he was just acting, but I would say then that he is a very good actor.
Definitely exceeds the Rod Steiger performance by leaps and bounds with that one moment. I hear you, man. I hear you.
Harry gave a very subtle performance.
Nuance.
Then they take off and everything. Okay, so big question. Do we even like this movie?
I found it fascinating and highly entertaining. And what was interesting is watching it and contrasting my reactions to it as a 12-year-old with my reactions as a middle-aged dude watching it, which is that I can see why on some, like, superficial goofball level, it actually worked and scared me as a kid. And I think it gets back to that sort of implied verisimilitude that you get from that whole made for TV bad reenactment feel that the movie has. It was like watching an episode of In Search Of, only the crappy reenactments are populated by like Oscar winning actors and shit. So it's very surreal, you know. Which is something that goes right over your head as a kid. But the thing that didn't go over my head is that it felt like I was watching a reenactment from In Search Of. And so for me, That was a little bit freaky. It's like, okay, maybe no matter how goofily this is depicted, it's depicting something that really happened.
That's a that take would have helped enjoy the film more. I found it, I really wanted to go in because I had the weird experience watching The Exorcist for the first time. I watched it, freaked me the hell out. Second time I watched it, it bored the shit out of me. And then the third time I watched it, it worked fantastic. So it was like really strange. So I'm going, maybe that will happen with this one. Because we talked about this years ago in our very early version of the podcast. Right. And I'm like, well, maybe I'll like it more this time. Nope. It is... It would be helped greatly by a 30-minute trim.
Oh, totally.
And a few other things, but it's still ultimately with it starts up and it dives right into Rod's scene. You know, it begins with a bang, literally, but then the first kind of big scene happens fairly quickly where the first big horror scene happens. And I'm going, okay, maybe it's good. No, this is it's just boring is the problem. It's not really flabby.
It is definitely flabby. I'll give you that.
Bad in the way an Italian movie can be very entertaining bad. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not bad enough to be a Bruno Mattei level amusing. but it's not good enough to be an Omen or an Exorcist or anything like that. It sits in that rough, bad world of the worst things films can be, which is boring.
I think for me, I agree. There's the middle section just sags absurdly. Mm-hmm. But as I shot through it fourth and fifth time, because I am an ex-Catholic, so please, I will put myself. This is probably why I'm a horror fan, is because I'm a fucking masochistic ex-Catholic. But as I'm watching it, I realize that there are peaks in the movie. There are definite peaks in the movie. And so for me, it became a glass half full thing. Yes, this is flabby as hell, but oh my God, the ham has been uncanned.
There are definitely some good moments.
Yeah.
If you were to condense and go, hey, here's the 25 minutes of really good scenes. You get the priest in the house, you get the psychic in the basement, you get the, kids crushing hand is kind of a disturbing scene. You take all those best moments and you built like a 30, 45 minute thing. And you say, well, this is what the movie's like. Oh, okay. This looks like a really good creepy horror film.
Yeah.
But then you drop in that missing 45 minutes to an hour.
The other thing that I think dampens it considerably is that it is that benign, flat, literal TV look that the movie has.
Yeah.
Overall, I think that really dampens it. Cause you think about, one of the other things that happened that I was thinking about a lot as I watched it is I was thinking about The Changeling, which is like a year after this movie. That is not just one of the best horror movies of the 80s. It's one of the best movies of the 80s.
It's fantastic.
It's just a brilliant movie. And part of it is because it narrows the focus and it lets an awful lot of what happens. It's not delivered through dialogue and exposition the way that this movie delivers shit with dialogue and exposition. It narrows the focus on one character and it lets you see how that character proceeds through the uncanny things that begin happening in this house that he's living in.
It lacks the cinematic moments.
Yeah.
When you talk about being a flat TV movie, it lacks the cinematic moments of she's a babysitter or whatever in The Omen. This is all for you. You've got that cinematic shot.
Yeah.
Or the scenes in The Exorcist with the priest showing up. You see, it's in the poster. It's in everything you do.
There's an iconic image, those
shots. And then the red ball in The Changeling. Yeah. And it doesn't have anything cinematic like that.
And it screams for that. It's interesting to think about that because we're also talking about American International Pictures at the time. I mean, this is a movie that had relatively A-list actors, but also it was American International Pictures right before they became Filmways and right before they completely died out. And it's Sam Arkoff's behind it. This is a guy who put his production muscle behind like Attack of the Crab Monsters, for God's sake. He's coming from that aesthetic. So, I mean,
we can do it for less, right?
Yeah, exactly. So he's coming from that aesthetic. And also, like you had noted at the outset, which I actually didn't know, it was intended as a TV movie. And it's just, one of the scenes that is really effective. I mean, it's a cop out because it's another fucking dream sequence. But there's the sequence where Kathy runs into a room, into like the girl's bedroom. She runs into Amy's bedroom and she sees George standing over her with an axe. Everything's bloody. The kid's staring wide-eyed, and Kathy Letts starts screaming, and then you see the axe coming down on her hand just as it's starting to split, and then, boom, she wakes up. Mm-hmm. That slapped me upside the head. That was a very viscerally effective, that was like a grindhouse effective scene. Yeah. And if the movie, you know, if you're going to make it a flat, bland-ass TV movie, give me some moments like that that are going to club me upside the head, you know, that are really going to, I mean, it's, you know, makes me think of like moments like that in The New York Ripper, which I think is another, which is an Italian movie, but it's another movie that's shot with almost a TV, made-for-TV flatness until you get to like the gore scenes. And then it's like the gloves are off. This movie could have used more moments like that, I think.
They definitely were going for it and putting it together. I mean, you go through the list of people that were offered Brolin's role, and it's fairly significant.
Yeah.
A-list actors at the time, and Margot was right off of Superman.
Right.
So you had, they were looking to do something bigger than I think they ended up being able to make, but yeah.
Yeah, there's another interesting thing, and actually my girlfriend pointed this out as we were watching it. Kathy Lutz's character and Margot Kidder in general in this movie she's very infantilized in places. The way she looks, she's got the pigtails.
Yeah.
At one point, she's dressed in what looks like a Japanese schoolgirl outfit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I find a very charming woman, but they're like making her not grown up. And it's like,
it's a good point.
Why?
Yeah,
you
know,
if you want an ingenue, cast an ingenue, you know? And I've always loved Margot Kidder. I think she's a great actor. Mm-hmm. And there are flashes of good work from her in this movie, but it's so disjointed and it's so patchy, you know, and there are so many times when the actors are called on, you know, or maybe they just decide to take it upon themselves to like be fucking ham on rye big time that it kind of offsets some of the like really organic reactions that she gives to some of the stuff that's going on.
Well, she doesn't like the movie.
Oh yeah,
she definitely hated Brolin too. Not one of her good roles.
She hated Brolin. I mean, it's, you know, they're very and again on the documentary that's on the DVD, they're very diplomatic as they talk about it. But it's obvious that Brolin was a guy who was at the tail end of the studio system, and he was, I'm going to learn my lines. I'm going to do everything exactly point by point as the director and the screenwriter have come to a consensus. I'm going to do this. And then she would breeze in and she'd be wanting to improvise. She'd be wanting to be the free spirit. She'd like, I just like to, you know, go wherever the role takes me, wherever I feel I need to go, you know, that sort of philosophy. And so when you get like this, you know, hardline old school guy, and that's the other thing, there is no romantic chemistry between these two people.
Zero.
None.
Not at all.
Zilch. And there's one point where she's like doing stretches and she's in like this negligee and it's just barely concealing the altogether. And you're like, wow. And he's like, basically he's treating her like she's, you know, like he's a, you know, a Grand Central Station, you know, fucking train terminal guy announcing the schedule. He's bored as fuck by this rather attractive woman wearing almost nothing and coming on to him in a big way. Oh God. And can we talk about the not quite measuring up scene that happens?
Oh, right. I need Viagra in my life.
Yeah, exactly. It happens to everybody. Not to me.
Well, you know, that's what every guy says in a movie
and
afterwards.
That's another thing. Of course, I'm 12 years old. That totally went over my head.
Sure.
You know, when I saw it, but this time I'm watching it, I'm like, wow, that's kind of brutal, you know? And it goes to feed into why you've got this whole cesspool of dysfunction going on, because he's coming from a psychological as well as a sexually stunted standpoint.
So, the next people who moved into the house.
Change the fucking
Jim and Barbara
subject.
Cromarty bought the house for $55,000 in March of 77.
Holy shit.
Wow.
They rejected all claims of the locks, the doors, the windows being broken. I mean, that whole claim of the the door being blown out and everything. They're like, this is clearly the door that has been here the entire time this house has been built, yes, and it is still here. They also said that the red room was a small closet in the basement and would have been known to the previous owners of the house because it was not concealed in any way. And then the claim that the house was built on a site where the Shinnecock Indians had once abandoned the mentally ill was rejected outright by the Shinnecock tribe.
Oh, shit.
And they said, no, that was never there.
See, now you're getting into what I was saying at the very beginning.
Oh,
the
let's world talk about
of what this movie devastated me as a kid, because I was all in on, oh man, it's real, I gotta see this, I gotta find out what's gonna happen. And the Lutz had appeared, I think, on the Today Show or the morning, whatever it would have been at that time. So I'm like, I've gotta watch this. And they don't outright say it's BS, because I think partially because they were under lawsuit consideration at the time, but they basically say we made it all up,
right?
And I remember watching it just being devastated by this movie. It's like, what? You guys lied?
There is no Santa Claus. God damn it.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Eric, I told you the first year I went to that horrifying convention over on the East Coast, George Lutz was a speaker there.
Oh,
and
my God.
I was like, oh, cool. So I went, sat in the panel. It was packed. Mm-hmm. And he basically came out and said, look, a few weird things happened there, but, you know, we made the whole thing up. And then, you know, at the end of it, any questions? All these hands shoot up. So the well to hell, how big was that? And this stuff, and he was just kind of, it felt like that William Shatner Saturday Night Live skit where he was just looking at the guy going, there was no well to hell. And, oh, all right. And then the next question was something about, you know, the haunting. And I was like, these people do not want to hear that this is not real.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of that around this movie. There's a lot of, no, it definitely happened. It's like,
yeah,
no,
I've got some other info here. No neighbors reported anything unusual during the time that the Lutzes were living there. Police officers are depicted visiting the house in the book and the film, but the records show that the Lutzes did not call the police during the period that they were living there.
Oh, wow.
And the Lutzes went on to live a relatively normal life afterwards. They divorced in the late 80s. Kathy died of emphysema in 2004, and George died of heart disease in 2006.
Oh. Have we got a little bit along those lines, too, with the lawsuit? Did you...
Well, yeah, I've got some other stuff in here. Did you know that Ronald DeFeo died in March of 2021?
No.
That, well, we were all thinking about other things, so
yeah,
it didn't really come up.
Yeah.
I've got some really interesting stuff from him here. So his story of hearing voices was pretty much bullshit. And it was built on what his lawyer was telling him to do. Claimed that the voices were in his head and the two of them would become very wealthy from book deals and such. Mm-hmm. His lawyer was William Weber, who would then go on to admit that he, George, and Kathy Lutz concocted the whole story over several bottles of wine. So,
yep.
So DeFeo's lawyer is the lawyer that sits down with George and Kathy Lutz and comes up with this entire story. Then they're getting sued because he's suing the Lutzes because for breach of contract when they decided to go with Jay Anson instead of the writer he had lined up for this. So probably could have milked this for a lot more. The Lutzes made very little money off of this whole thing, out of the whole Amityville Horror franchise. I think that I read something like they might have made $300,000 out of everything.
Wow. Couldn't have if you'd caught their house,
over
I guess.
Over the course of how many decades, you know?
Well, and towards the end there, George Lutz tried to copyright the Amityville Horror name.
Oh, okay.
But because, like I said, because it's, you know, a matter of public record, that's why you're not seeing Amityville Horror 13th, the shark Amityville. You're just seeing Amityville shark because you can't copyright the name of a town.
Amityville in the hood.
Right. I've got some cool information though here that I dug up. So apparently the detective on the scene testified that he believed there were two killers. Because it's not just one gun that was used in these murders.
Oh, so you're talking about the actual guns.
Yeah.
Okay.
So two guns were used, and that he thought that would explain why the killer would have had time to kill everybody before waking them up instead of going from room to room in this gigantic house and nobody waking up. This then gets into some crazy stuff. Now, we can just...
Are you sure? I'm sorry to interrupt, but are you sure you don't want to save this for the episode on Amityville 2?
Well, I thought that this was... you know, we can talk about that then, too. But I thought this was so interesting because it really goes to show... DeFeo, obviously, some mental issues there. I think if you're going to kill your entire family, we can go out on a limb and say you're crazy in some way. In 86, he changed his story and claimed that his sister Dawn killed their father, and then their distraught mother killed all of the siblings before he killed his mom. Wow. He says that he took the blame because he was afraid to say anything negative about his mother to her father and his father's uncle out of fear that they would kill him. His father's uncle being Peter DeFeo, who was a capo regime in the Genovese crime family.
Oh, my.
Yes. So that's interesting. That's 86, right? In 1990, DeFeo asserted that Don and an unknown assailant who fled the house before he could get a good look at him killed their parents, and then Don subsequently killed their siblings. He said the only person he killed was Don and that it was by accident as they struggled over the rifle. Then in 2000, he claimed that he had committed the murders with his sister Dawn and two friends out of desperation because his parents had plotted to kill him. DeFeo claimed that he and his sister planned to kill their parents, but then Dawn murdered the children in order to eliminate them as witnesses. He said that he was enraged on discovering his sister's actions, knocked her unconscious onto the bed, and shot her in the head. Police found traces of unburned gunpowder on Dawn's nightgown, which DeFeo proponents allege proves that she discharged a firearm. So,
wow.
Yeah, some weird, crazy stories. The judge in all of these has basically said, I don't buy it. But there's one really interesting thing here. In 2001, a judge unsealed the remainder of the Weber versus Lutz court files. And what was unsealed was the simple affirmation of the Catholic priest, played by Rod Steiger, who testified under oath that the events described in Jay Anson's book never, ever transpired.
So, I've got a couple weird notes that are movie related. I mean, really weird. How about this one? Elsa Raven, the real estate agent.
Yes.
Her first film was The Honeymoon Killers.
Oh, wow.
So she got to work with Martin Scorsese for 1 week. Because he shot 1 week on that
film. That's right.
And then somebody else, and then two other directors finished it off.
Yeah.
So that's like, oh, that's an interesting one. Or Jay Anson, the writer of the novel, also wrote a series of movie making, which were basically promotional material for films in the 60s and early 70s, like 8 or 10 minute little pieces. He did one for Oliver, The Green Beret, and XXX movie, Lolly Madonna.
Oh, my.
What else weird shit happened? I did not realize this. So I was reading it that it was not shot in the Amityville house.
No.
At all. It was because they wouldn't let him. City wouldn't let him shoot.
That, and also, at least Hans Holzer in the commentary says that it wasn't photogenic enough. House wasn't
nice
large and photogenic enough for them to actually use, so they had to basically, you know. I forget if it was a different house or if they just built it from whole cloth, but yeah.
Right, yeah. I would imagine that. I mean, houses were smaller.
Absolutely.
In the 70s, 60s and 70s. They were... Yes. Much smaller footprints.
When I was looking up the sales history of this, the house is on Zillow. You can look.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, okay. You can look through all the pictures on it, and it's a big, beautiful house. Wow. I mean, man, it is cool looking.
Cool. I'm sure you know you do a lot of work when you buy that house to make sure it does not look like a rundown house.
Right.
So I have a couple of little bits of trivia about some of the actors that are in the movie that we haven't really touched on. And if you guys are about
the Italian horror movies they've been in?
No, unfortunately, no Italian horror cred. Natasha Ryan, the little girl who plays Amy, Lutz's daughter, was actually kind of a go-to kid in peril in the 70s. She was a regular on the Days of Our Lives soap opera for quite a few years. And she is the kid in peril in Kingdom of the Spiders, who is rescued by William Shatner.
Oh, she is? Wow.
One of the Lutz boys is played by a child actor named Mino Pellucci, who
sounds kind of Italian.
Yes, it does. Although he's an American Italian kid,
it's pronounced Mino Pellucci.
I would not be surprised. He was actually in the brief TV series version of The Bad News Bears.
Oh.
And he was also the lead opposite John Eric Hexum in the TV series, and I forget the name of the TV series, that the two of them were working on as time travelers when during one of the onset days, Hexum put a gun to his head joking around and pulled the trigger because, oh, look, this is this. There's no bullets in this. And then, of course,
what was that show?
It was something like Time just Travelers. He was just a character that was opposite John Eric Hexum's character. And I think they had only shot like an episode or two before Hexum had that horrible accident. But Mino Pellucci, one of the Lutz kids in the movie. I don't know if he was there when John Eric Hexum killed himself by accident, but a little footnote in movie trivia history for you guys.
I've got one little piece here. James Brolin took less money up front, but with a promise of 10% of the gross sales after its release.
Oh, yeah.
After the movie became an unexpected blockbuster, he eventually received about $17 million. If adjusted for inflation, that would be equivalent to a little over $55 million.
Oh,
for his
nice job, Nike. Brolin, James. Yeah.
Well played.
He didn't want to take the movie. He thought it was, a load of bullshit. Basically came right out and said, he met with George and Kathy and everything. And afterwards he was like, they seem very nice, but this is a load of bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. He talks in the documentary that's on the DVD. He talks about how George Lutz was a great salesman. He could have sold you sand, and that's his very diplomatic way of saying, this guy is charming, but he's full of shit.
Yeah. He came out a little while later after the movie was done and tried to say that he wasn't able to get any jobs for like 2 years because his character was so mean, but he actually had Night of the Juggler in 1980, Risk in 1981, and two made for TV movies in the 2 years following. So he had no problem getting hired.
Yeah. I mean, that guy is one good looking piece of man meat.
Sure. Yes, he is.
Except for all the no sleep and the freezing look and everything that he's got going on in this.
But hygiene.
Yeah, yes. When we first meet him, though, I'm just like, boy, that is a man right there.
Yeah. He's like what everybody wants God to look like in movies. He's got the flowing mane and the beard. Perfectly handsome dude. Yeah, it's funny because his grouchy, deadpan performance actually works in favor of the character most of the time, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a guy, Night of the Juggler, man.
That's good.
A really underrated. I haven't seen that in ages.
I love that movie. I just saw it recently for the first time, and it is really, really good.
Get a look at
nice.
It.
Okay, so we're winding up. Tony, tell us what you got going on. You've got another podcast that you do, right?
I work with three good friends of mine on a podcast called City of Geek, and we just recently did our first episode in almost 2 years. I also have something on the back burner that I'm hoping to move to the front burner very soon that I may receive some moral and technical assistance from somebody at this table here, which I'm looking forward to. I don't want to talk too much about that because I feel like it's jinxing myself if I do. Artisthome.org. I cover Northwest music and I love getting on the bully pulpit for local bands and artists. And thesunbreak.com. I get to write about new movies most of the time. And I try to, again, do an emphasis on Pacific Northwest films and filmmakers.
And also, if you do come out to Crypticon, you'll probably see Tony interviewing some of the bigger guests. He does amazing interviews.
Really good. Thank you. I love doing it. And I spending 45 minutes of undivided time talking to a childhood hero or a childhood crush, what's not to like about that?
Yeah.
In a room full of people who are totally into the same thing.
Yes.
That's one of the things, many things I love about Crypticon is it's brought us together, and it enables me to do that every year.
Eric, cool. Talk a little bit about Crypticon for the people who don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, it's a horror convention here in Seattle, and Crypticon Seattle. Oh, look at that. It happens at the end of May, and it's down at the Doubletree SeaTac. So if you fly in, just walk across the street, and you're there.
And Eric, you run the film festival for Crypticon.
The film festival there at this point, still going through the submissions. We're at closing in on the most submissions we've ever received. I'm looking forward to seeing what comes together from it.
Yeah, me too. And of course, if you're here, you're either a huge fan of the Amityville Horror and you found us that way, or you are following Eric and I over from our regular podcast of Strangeons Radio. So that you can find us there every week. This podcast is going to be less structured than that as far as the time goes. Yeah. I think that this will probably come out once a month, maybe, because, you know, we watch a lot of movies for that podcast, and these movies are going to get less pleasant to watch as we continue on. So I don't feel like we need to watch an Amityville movie a week or anything
like
that. Gotta
crank up our cheese abilities more.
But that's it then. I really, really want to thank everybody who listened. And please, you know, reach out if you like this. Let us know how you felt about it. And we'll be back. You know, we'll let you know when the next episode is coming out. Don't worry. Tony. Thank you so much for joining us for this.
As always, gentlemen, an absolute pleasure and an honor to bullshit over cinema with the two of you.
And we'll get you back. I want to make this something where we have a different guest every week, but it doesn't have to be like, we'll never see you again. We'll get you back for another one of these.
Definitely.
And probably for more than you want, if we're being honest.
I don't know if we, I'm bummed that I'll be missing out on the Amityville 2 podcast, because that's actually probably my favorite Amityville movie.
Oh, nice.
I think it's really no better quality wise than any of the others, but I think it has a blunt force efficacy that that works. And also, speaking of Crypticon, many years ago, one of my first interviews at Crypticon was Diane Franklin, the leading lady from Amityville 2.
There we go.
But anyway, she's great. That is for another episode. That is for another rotating guest. And I will be listening raptly to that episode.
Thank you very much. All right, everybody. We'll see you next episode.
Ciao.
See ya.
Transportation and other considerations for Strange Eons Radio produced by Pan Am Airlines. When you think of traveling, think of Pan Am. You can't beat the experience. Guests of Strange Eons Radio stay at Econo Lodge Everett. It's an easy stop on the road, you know what I mean. Strange Eons Radio is recorded live in front of a studio audience. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a positive review on your favorite podcast app. Sit, Ubu, sit.